Thank you very much. It's a visit to PI 6 years later, so it's nice to be back. Today, I'm going to give a talk on the progress we had with understanding the modelized space of instantons. It's a classical problem. It's been there for many years, since roughly the 70s, when the ADHM proposed the formulation of the modelized space of instantons. And we managed to get an understanding using methods in gauge theories, and in particular, from understanding of Coulomb branch in a supersymmetric gauge theory in three dimensions. So let's start by giving the problem. So an instanton would be a solution to the equation F equals star F, and F is a joint valued in some gauge group. G. And this is a classical equation, and we are interested in finding the space of solutions of this classical equation. This is called the modelized space of instantons. And it depends on three parameters denoted by mk, the group, and also the space that we work on. We will pick the space to be C2. One can pick any four manifold. And I won't have anything to say about the generic four manifold. We will just restrict to C2 because this is also the way it naturally arises in string theory in the context of some certain brain systems. Now, so in order to specify the space of solutions, you need to provide these three numbers. K is the instanton number. And it is an integer number related to the integral f wedge f. You need to put some normalization such that it will be an integer. And we want to study the k instanton solution. And the group G can be any simple gauge group, including the exceptionals. And the exceptional, in fact, is the main point of this talk, because we managed to get some solution for the case that the gauge group is exceptional. Now, okay, let's do a simple example. Take the gauge group to be SU2, and k is equal to 1. And here we have an A-parameter solution, A-parameter space of solutions. And the way we can think of it is as there is a copy of C2. That's the set of positions of the instantons. So as you could see, this equation is translation invariant. And so I can just place the instanton anywhere I wish. So there's going to be a copy of C2. There's going to be also a size. The size of the instanton, you see that this equation is scale invariant. And the instanton solution can have any size. And finally, the parameters, there is an S3, that's the, I can embed the instanton into the group manifold SU2. This group manifold is parameterized by three angles, except that there is a Z2 action, the Weyl group of SU2 acts on this space of angles, and I get this projective space. And together, those two become C2 mod Z2. Right, so as a complex manifold, the moduli space of the one SU2 instanton is C2, the copy of the position, and the orbifold C2 mod Z2. Now, let me tell you some general features of this moduli space. So the moduli space is a hyperkähler cone of a dimension which is proportional to the instanton number times the dual Coxeter number of the gauge group. So this is the dual Coxeter number. And one simple way of, and of course, this is since this is a hyperkähler cone, this dimension is measured in the units of 4. So this is the quaternionic dimension. If you want the real dimension, just multiply by 4. Now, one way of computing that this is indeed the dimension of the moduli space is to think of the one instanton solution as an embedding of the SU2 gauge group into the group. So for the case of one instanton, one way of saying that there is a C2, and then there is a space, let's call it M tilde, that's the reduced instanton moduli space. And if I want to think of it as an embedding of SU2 into the group, what I need to do is to compute the coset G modded out by SU2 times H, where H is the commutant of SU2 inside G. And then I just multiply this by the space of SU2. So you know this is not a direct product. There is this, and together they form a single hyperkähler cone. But at least from here, I can get the dimension. I cannot get the exact structure of this moduli space, but I can compute the dimension here. The dimension is just the dimension of the group, minus 3, minus the dimension of H. And here I add 4 real more dimensions, and I get the dimension of the moduli space to be K times the dual Coxeter number. Any questions about this point? I'm going fast here because it's well-known stuff. And, if you want me to elaborate, I can do that. But
sorry. Yeah, there's no K appearing. So.
Yeah, so this is for one instanton, and
for K-1.
Right. So if in order to understand why it is like that, we just need to figure out that the dimension is linear in K, and what I'll do is just to put all of the instantons far apart, very small and far apart. So then each instanton will have individually the dimension of a single instanton. And I'll just have moduli here, so I'll add them up. Right? So as far as the dimension is concerned, I should expect that the number is linear in K with no additional factor. And then per single instanton, I'll just do this computation, and I'll get the dimension. So I mean, in fact, I can do an example if you just pick your favorite group, then we'll do an example of how it comes about to be the dual Coxeter number. But in fact, there's finite number of cases, so you could just compute it and see that it always turns out to be like that. Okay, so if you want to do an example, I can do that, but if not, we could skip to the next point. Any more questions? Good, okay. So, yeah, so this is known stuff. Let me just now describe the ADHM construction. ADHM proposed a solution to the moduli space of instantons for the gauge group where G is either SUN, SPN, or SON. Or in other words, all of the classical groups. And their proposal was a nice set of algebraic equations. And today they are called, as a set of algebraic equations. When they first introduced it, it was kind of mysterious, at least from the point of view of a physicist. But today we understand that this is nothing but a hyperkähler quotient. And a hyperkähler quotient, for us, is something which is quite natural for a gauge theory, from a gauge theory's point of view, because this is just a solution of F and D term equations. Right, so if I say this to a physicist, oh, now I understand the F and D term equations, this I know how to handle. However, if I'll say hyperkähler quotient, that might be mysterious, set of algebraic equations, it's not clear. So the nice thing about ADHM is that that's just a set of equations for the vacuum equations of a certain gauge theory, and what we need to do is just to specify which specific gauge theory it was. Okay, so let's specify. Now we will call it the ADHM quiver. And the ADHM quiver for group SUN is going to look like this. It's a quiver made out of two groups. One is gauge, the other is not gauge. Here, the gauge group is UK, and the flavor group is SUN. And there's one more adjoint hypermultiplet in the adjoint representation. And now the statement is that the Higgs bunch of this quiver theory is the moduli space of instantons of KSUN instantons on C2. Any questions about this point? Okay, so let's explicitly write down the set of equations. In order to do that, I'll expand what I mean by this quiver. I'll put a UK gauge symmetry here. I'll put two fields. Let's them call them Q and Q tilde. And here I'll have three adjoint fields, which I will call X, phi, and Y, just to make it interesting. And the superpotential is going to look like a commutator of phi, trace of the commutator of phi and X, Y. where phi is k by k, x is again the same, and y like that, and q is k by n, and q tilde is n by k. Okay, so I'll have another term, and this term is going to look like phi trace of phi q tilde, like that. Okay? So I wrote for you the different fields. Those are, each one of them is a chiral multiplet, matrix valued, and this is the superpotential. From here, I derive the F-term equations, which will tell me that with respect to phi, I'll get this equation that the commutator of x and y is equal to q tilde. Okay, so these are the so-called ADHM equations. And in order to compute the Higgs branch, what I need to do is to take the space of all gauge invariant operators that satisfies this F-term equation. Okay? And in fact, we can easily compute the dimension of this moduli space. So the dimension of the Higgs branch is equal to the number of hypermultiplets that I find, which is k times n plus k squared. And I need to gauge a uk on the Higgs branch, k squared. Vector multiplets become massive, and I'm left with k times n. And n indeed is the dual Coxeter number of SUN. So I recover this formula. Any questions? We're still in the simple stuff story. Okay? Good. So let me just do the ADHM for G, SON, and SPN. They will look very similar. I'll just need to, so the quiver is the same. I'll just need to change the way these guys, the different groups. So the global group for SON is SON here. Here I'll have SPK. And instead of a joint, I will have a second rank antisymmetric, which I'll denote by A, like that. Second rank antisymmetric is reducible. There is a singlet there, and that singlet serves as the position of the instanton. Okay, so this is the ADHM quiver for SON. Gate symmetries, and by complete analogy, we can do the SPN and OK here. And now the loop corresponds to a second rank symmetric tensor. So hypermultiplet in the second rank symmetric tensor. Again, second rank symmetric is reducible, and the singlet is the position, the overall position of the instantons. Any more questions? Now, so that's roughly the situation as it was after the ADHM solution.
Can you explain why there's this connection here, or it's obvious?
Oh, I can offer some nice explanation in terms of brains. So imagine that you have a brain system. And suppose that you take a DP brain and a DP plus 4 brain. And so let's take the case of the group to be UN. And now suppose that I represent the DP brain by a small line like that, and then the DP plus 4 brain like that. In fact, I should represent the DP brain as a point. Some point. and this is the space transverse to the P brain, to the P plus 4 brain. So that's a copy of R. How much is this transverse to this? So it's going to be 5 minus P. And along this direction, it's going to be C2. That's where I will embed the instanton. And now there are two types of strings that we can think of in this configuration. I can just use perturbative open strings in order to characterize this system. There is an open string which is stretched between the DP brain and the P plus 4 brain. And there are also some strings which stretch from the DP brain to itself. And that's a caricature for the quiver that we see over here, right? This line is the corresponds to the string stretching between the DP brain and the DP plus 4 brain. And the line, this adjoint field over here, corresponds to strings from the DP brain to itself. From the set, I have K of them over here. I have N of them over here. Right, so this is the gauge theory that lives on the DP brain. And when you analyze what happens to the DP brain, it has two branches. It has the branch where the P brain is outside the P plus 4 brain. That's called the Coulomb branch. And we have nothing. I mean, it's not of interest for the interpretation as an instanton. And then there is the more interesting part where the, you can place the D4 brain inside. And then it just carries an instanton number. And it gets the interpretation as an instanton for an observer that lives in P plus 4, on the P plus 4 brain. And so the phase in which the brain is inside is called the Higgs branch. And now we get an identification that the Higgs branch of this quiver theory is the moduli space of instantons. So this is, if you want, the physics intuitive explanation of why the ADHM equations, which were derived by just taking these field equations here and doing some linear expansion. And they got these equations. However, they didn't offer any physical explanation for where it comes from. And using brains, it becomes very natural. Okay, and again, this is all, at least to the string theorists, I suppose this is all non-stuff, but I'll be happy to elaborate more on these things if you want, or maybe there are any other questions. Good. So now, you know, if you want to get the other classical groups, what you need to do is to put an orientiform plane over here. And you can put an orientiform plane which will change the group from UN to SON or from UN to SPN, and that will give you those quivers. And again, now you're left with the task of analyzing the Higgs branch of this particular quiver, and it will give you information about the moduli space of instance. So it's a nice way of thinking about it. But there is a downside to it. What is the downside? I'm restricted to only play with these groups, and I cannot go beyond. I have those different groups. They are classified into four families in the Cartan classification. And I cannot do anything with the exceptional groups. Right? So in order to think about the exceptional groups, I need to refer to a new way of thinking about these moduli spaces. And in fact, this after ADHM, there was an open problem how to think of moduli space of instantons for exceptional groups. OK, so what can we do better? So we could, instead of thinking of the moduli space of instantons as a Higgs branch of a certain gauge theory, like here, what we will do now is to improve this by thinking of the the moduli space of instantons as a Coulomb branch. And indeed, this goes back quite some time, in, at least in the gauge theory literature. As far as I can tell, back to 95. Was it 95? No, I think it was 96. 96. Intelligator and Zeiberg come up with the idea that they have a three-dimensional gauge theory, a 3D gauge theory with n equals 4 supersymmetry. With, this means that 8 supercharges. And this theory has a very specific theory. You take the Coulomb branch, and it's known that this Coulomb branch is a hyperkähler cone, and it coincides with the moduli space of instantons. And what is their proposal? They say, OK, let's take for the AN case. So the gauge group now is SU n plus 1. And they say, in this case, take the following quiver, which is made out of a, that's a necklace quiver. So it has n plus 1 nodes. And let's just take their proposal. So in their proposal, they just put a rank 1 in each gauge group. And they say that the Coulomb branch of this gauge theory, and when I think of this gauge theory, I should think of a product of U1 gauge theories, which are coupled to each other by a collection of bifundamental hypermultiplets. One line per each hypermultiplet. And then they tell us that the Coulomb branch of this theory is the moduli space of one SU n plus 1 instanton on C2. OK? So that's very nice. If this is the case, we could try and extend this proposal to other cases. And indeed, in that paper, they also say, OK, let's take for Dn, just take the affine quiver, and you interpret it. You put ranks 1, 2, like that. And you interpret this as a quiver gauge theory. Now a collection of U2 gauge groups and four U1 gauge groups. And again, they tell us that the Coulomb branch is the moduli space of one SO2N instanton on C2. OK? And they go even further and put a conjecture. This is, at that time, it was a very wild conjecture. For E6, you just take the affine E6 symmetry with this particular specific ranks of the gauge groups, and you take this Coulomb, the Coulomb branch of this theory, and you get the E6 instanton theory. Any questions so far? Let me just draw, while I'm waiting for questions, I'll draw the cases of E7 and E8. So if you haven't seen this before, there is room for some questions. If you've seen this before, then that's probably not new so much. OK, these are the specific gauge theories. And if I think of it as a three-dimensional n equals 4, every node is a vector multiplet which contains one gauge field, three scalars, and fermions, three real scalars, and each line in this quiver is a bifundamental that transforms in the specific groups that are specified over here. If we have U6 times U5, then these are 30 hypermultiplets in the bifundamental representation. Okay, any questions? Now, well, so this was the proposal by Intelligator and Zyber, except that they were not sure how to compute, how to show that this is correct, how to give support, and in fact, it's not just them. Since then, since this proposal, the proposal stayed like that, and there was no action in this topic for years, and it was not clear how to show that this is indeed having to do anything with the modelized space of instantons. In fact, here I should point the work by Bashkirov, raise your hand over there, which did, after many years, find that if you take the quivers over here, you find that the first states in this gauge theory transform the joint representation of the corresponding group, and that's a very good test towards this conjecture which was put forward. I don't know if you gave talks about this over here. Anyhow, so then the proposal left the questions. First of all, we have some nice progress because we could deal with the exceptional groups, at least for the case of one instanton, we can do that. And now there is the natural question, how to extend it to other exceptional groups and how to extend it to a higher number of instantons. So the second question turns out to be quite easy. And let me give you the formulation of the final answer. So for k instantons, you need to take the extended affine quiver with ranks given by k times the Dynkin labels, or the dual Coxeter labels, let's call them. Yes, so in representation theory, those numbers, those are very specific numbers. They are called the dual Coxeter labels, and they are just the coefficients of the highest root in terms of the different fundamental weights of the algebra. And so what I need to do is to just multiply by k all of these ranks. So instead of a u1 to the n plus 1 gauge theory over here, I will take a uk to the n plus 1. However, I need to also have an extension. And the extended node does not get multiplied by k. And so let me just do the an case again. It's going to look like here's the extension, it has rank 1, then there is a k, more nodes, and they close same number of nodes, except that I just added one more node, and that's the extension for D, for A type. For D type, I'll just need to take this and add one more node. So I'll just need to take all of these constructions and add one more node for the extended affine group. So I'll just give the example. For the D type, I'll have 1, k, k, 2k, 2k, and then it becomes 2k, 2k, k, and k. Okay, so this is the corresponding quiver, and now I should think of it as u1 times uk to the fourth times u2k to the power n minus 3, and that's the gauge symmetry. Then you have the hypermultiplets, and I need to compute the Coulomb branch for this theory, and this will be coinciding with the moduli space of k instantons. So, any questions? So what do I do for G2 and F4? So for G2, something special happens. Nodes come in different lengths. Here's G2, and now we'll put the Dynkin labels, multiply them. And I'll add one more for the affine, and one more for the extension. Okay, so here's the quiver for G2. And now I should think of it as a UK squared U2K gauge theory. However, I need to worry about this edge because this is not a standard edge. Right? So we have a challenge here to understand what it means. In fact, understanding what this means was the final point in getting the right answer for the moduli space of instantons for any gauge group, not just for the classical ones. So I'll do the F4 as well. So the F4, let's first start with the the finite dimensional F4. So here's k, 2k, 3k, 2k. There is an extension. Sorry, that's the affine, and this is the extension. Okay? So this is the quiver. And perhaps I will do the non-simply laced groups. So let's do the BN. So the BN looks like that. Here's the 2K, 2K, K, and K. There is an extension over here, but now at the end, you'll have a 2K and a K. Okay, so this again is the corresponding quiver that I will use in order to compute the moduli space of instantons. And finally, for CN, I will take the group, and here I'll have a K. The last node is bigger, and they will all have K. And let's put dots here, and then this is the extension, the affine, and the extension. Any questions? So I think I'm done now with all groups. We did the all groups, and I offer the quivers for each of these cases. And in particular, notice the non-simply laced cases. We gave special attention to the non-simply laced cases because each of these cases have these special edges where we have a connection between roots that have different length. Okay? So simply laced algebras have a natural extension, and this natural extension was already given back immediately after Intrelic, Gator, and Zeibel. People understood what to do. However, it was left as a big question how to do the non-simply laced cases. And more than that, it was not clear how to test. Right? There was a conjecture. Right? There was a conjecture. This is a Coulomb branch. There is a hyperkeller quorum. This was understood. But how do you test that indeed this has something to do with the moduli space of instantons? Okay. And now comes the part that we got a very nice progress in understanding Coulomb branches of three-dimensional gauge theory, and it was for theory. And maybe it's time that I'll give some credit. So all of this stuff that I'm telling you over here is written in a paper by Ferlito, Cremonesi, and Meccaria. And the stuff about Coulomb branch of three-dimensional gauge theory was done with Cremonesi and Zaffaroni. And in that paper, so now I'm done describing the quivers, and from now on I will give general discussion about Coulomb branches of three-dimensional gauge theories. So this is a good point to ask for questions if there are any questions about the normalized space of instantons.
But what about the same question? Do you explain the physics of like 3D equations using 3D gauge theories?
We do have brain pictures for the classical groups, but we don't have brain pictures for the exceptional groups. That's an open problem, and I don't know the answer to that. But I can give you a case where there is a non-simply laced algebra, and still we do have a brain picture for that, and we have some level of understanding of these special edges as far as the brain system is concerned.
I think he's asking why 3D.
Sorry?
Why 3D?
Oh, why three dimensions? Oh, sorry. Yes. Okay. So that's a good question. So let me say Coulomb branches in general dimensions, d less or equal to 6. So what happens in these dimensions? The thing is that if you look at a vector multiplet, it contains six minus d scalar fields. Okay, so as a result, in if I give you a gauge theory in six dimensions and I look at the vector multiplet fields, then I have just a gauge field, no scalar fields, and fermions. So there's no moduli space which is associated to vector multiplets. However, if I'm in five dimensions, there will be one scalar field per vector multiplet. And if I have a collection of such vector multiplets, then I'll get a moduli space which has a dimension, a real dimension, equal to the number of vector multiplets. If I'm in four dimensions, then I'll have two real scalar fields or one complex, and I'll have a moduli space which is complex dimensional, as many as the number of vector multiplets. And if you want, the Zeiberg-Witten theory is based on this simple fact, and then there are plenty of other features which come about it. And indeed, in four dimensions, there was a lot of attention which was devoted to such moduli spaces. Less so, it was for three dimensions. So what happens for three dimensions? Now I have three scalar fields, three real scalar fields. However, there is an interesting feature that the gauge field is dual to a scalar. That gives me a fourth scalar. And so I get a space which has a natural dimension 4. And in the low energy limit, this space, in fact, becomes a hyperkähler cone. The cone feature is just in the infrared. And that's where it becomes interesting from the point of view of application to the moduli space of instantons. And now you can imagine that if you take as many vector multiplets as the dimension of the moduli space, then at least as far as the dimension is concerned, you could construct the moduli space of instantons. So what is the dimension of, let's say, over here? The dimension of this moduli space is just the sum of ranks. Right? So I just need to sum up these numbers. And if I sum up these numbers, I'll get that they are nothing but equal to the dual Coxeter number. Right? So here, for the case of V8, sum it up, you should get so you have 21 plus 6 plus 3, that's 30. That's the dual Coxeter number of E8 and so on, right? So if I sum up those numbers, I'll get this dual Coxeter number. And in fact, it gives you a nice understanding of the structure of the moduli space, that the contribution for each dual Coxeter number comes from the each of these gauge sectors over here. Right? So from this gauge group, I'll have a contribution of 5 to the moduli space and so on. Okay? Any questions about what I said? Good. So let's. What's the big thing about understanding Coulomb branches of three-dimensional n equals 4 theories? Here there are two types of operators in the chiral ring. And there are two types. One type is just the classical operators. And in fact, to understand those classical operators, it's enough that you'll understand the four-dimensional physics. And it is quite well known that if you want to study Zeigler-Witten theories, you parameterize the moduli space by the space of Casimir invariants. Space of Casimir invariants of the gauge group that you are dealing with. So those are the classical operators, and that's a nice thing. But then there is another set, the set of quantum operators. That's the hard part. And because of these quantum operators, it was a great difficulty to understand the structure of these moduli spaces. So this brings us back to the work of Anton and his students. And that's what led to the work of Bashkirov. There are monopole operators over here. And those monopole operators, you could think of them as a disorder operator, which are placed at the point, and they carry some monopole charge with respect to the set of U1 gauge fields in the problem. Okay, so the task that we have here is to try and understand all of these operators, the classical operators, the monopole operators. I can also come up with dressed monopole operators. And those are, you could think of the monopole operators as a kind of an operator in a super selection sector, which is characterized by magnetic charges. And on top of this guy, I can add many small fluctuations given by the Casimir invariants of the corresponding groups. And the set of all such operators will form a chiral ring. And I want to understand what are the generators of this chiral ring. This chiral ring is finitely generated. So I want to understand the generators. And I want to understand what are the relations that they satisfy. And if I'll do that, then I'll have an algebraic description of the moduli space of monopoles, of instantons. Or in general, more generally, I can take any quiver that I wish. I can take any three-dimensional gauge theory. And for this, I want to understand the structure of the chiral ring, the set of generators of the chiral ring, and the relations that they satisfy. OK? Questions? So let's do an example. And the typical example that you'll find in many papers is U1 with two flavors. This is a simple theory to analyze. It's the first theory, which is non-trivial and the easiest to analyze and to introduce all of these concepts of monopole operators, Casimir invariants, and the relations that they satisfy. Incidentally, look at the ADHM quiver. If you set k equals 1 and n equals to 2, that's the moduli space of one SU2 instanton, provided that you don't have the loop. But the loop here decouples. It carries charge 0, just completely decouples. It forms a C2, and it has the physical interpretation of giving the position of the instanton. So I just factor it out. It's a trivial sector. So if I understand the Higgs branch of this theory, I will have the moduli space of instantons. But very interestingly, there is a feature that I did not discuss so far that is called mirror symmetry. Going back to the paper of Integral Gator and Zyber, there is a three-dimensional mirror. And this theory is, in fact, self-mirror. So even if I understand the Coulomb branch of this theory, I will get the same moduli space. You had some talks about mirror symmetry over here? Did you give him some?
No, I'm over to a group meeting, but
yeah. So there is a notion of three-dimensional mirror symmetry, which we will probably have not much time to discuss, but it's certainly there in the background, right? If you want to think about three-dimensional gauge theories with n equal 4 supersymmetry, this is an important ingredient. So I'll just mention it as a phrase, but now let's try to analyze the Coulomb branch. Right? So the Coulomb branch of this theory it has a dimension 1. So the dimension of the Coulomb branch is 1. And here again, I'm counting in quaternionic units. There is one vector multiplet, carries 3 scalars, and a compact scalar, which is dual to the gauge field. Now, there is a monopole operator. So, OK. Let's start with the Casimir invariants. What is the Casimir invariant? I have a scalar field in the vector multiplet. Vector multiplet contains a scalar field, which I will take to be complex valued. We have 8 minutes. Very good. OK, so we'll see what we can do in 8 minutes. So a vector multiplet contains a complex scalar field, a real scalar field, which we will call sigma, and the dual of a gauge field, which we will call, call the dual of the gauge field sigma, and the real part, phi r, called the third scalar field in this vector multiplet. Now, we have 8 minutes, so I'll just be brief and say that these two guys in the quantum theory get replaced by monopole operators which carry a magnetic charge. And this phi is a classical operator which is a chiral multiplet. And so I can take any positive powers of this chiral multiplet in the chiral ring. Now, what's special about these monopole operators? So here are the monopole operators. And we have a nice feature that the magnetic charge can be any magnetic charge that we have. Right? This is a U1 gauge theory. It has a collection of magnetic charges. And M can be, in fact, any integer number. So I have the set of all chiral fields, Vm, and phi to the k. This is a complete set of all fields in the chiral ring, where k must be a non-negative power. Okay. And now I can ask, what kind of variety can I generate out of these monopole operators and the Casimir invariants? And it turns out that the relation that they satisfy is this one, V1 times V minus 1 is equal to phi squared, giving me the algebraic equation for C2 mod Z2. So I recover the relation or the space that we said at the beginning of the talk about the moduli space of one SU2 instanton. And now you could ask, how can I get these relations? Where do I get this form? So let me present the way we do it. We have six boards, you said?
Yep.
And now I need to move to the next one. Okay, and so in order to derive these relations, we compute the Hilbert series. So that's the last concept. Hyper-K-Lacan. And I'm going to do it for a specific for n equals 4 three-dimensional gauge theory. And I represent it by writing down a formula. So the Hilbert series of a certain set of variables, let's call it Zi, and stop here, is given by the set. It's a sum. It's sum over an algebraic quantity. This is going to be the lattice of charges. So let me denote it by gamma. And divide it by an action of the Weyl group. So gamma is the GNO lattice. And I hope that some of you have played with GNO lattices. So if I get if I have a group, there is a lattice of magnetic charges. This is called the GNO lattice. It's the lattice of the dual gauge group in the notion of the Langlands dual. And here W is the Weyl group. So of the corresponding group. And so what I need to do is to take the lattice of magnetic charges and just pick a certain Weyl chamber, let's say the dominant Weyl chamber of this particular group. So the dominant Weyl chamber of the GNO lattice. Then I need to sum t to the 2 delta, and delta was computed by the group of Anton. This is the spin of spin under SU2R of the monopole operator. And this delta is a function of all of the magnetic charges. So if I have a point in this lattice, delta is going to be a function of these charges. And in fact, it's a very simple formula. So we will write it down. And then I'll get the contribution from, I'll write it as P of M. This is the contribution from the Casimir invariants from the sector of classical operators. P gets the form of the product I over the rank of the group, 1 over 1 minus t to the 2 di, where di are the set of degrees of Casimir invariants. And I need to tell you which Casimir invariant. So you see there is a dependence on M. So the point is that physically, when I place an operator with a monopole operator that has a collection of magnetic charges, it generically breaks the gauge symmetry. Right? So gauge symmetry is broken to a subgroup of the original gauge group. It's called the stabilizer of the point in the inside the group. And so there's going to be a residual gauge symmetry, and the Casimir invariants are of the residual gauge symmetry. Symmetry, which is left invariant, by the set of charges. Okay, and finally, I'll put a factor. There's going to be a collection of topological charges. Three-dimensional gauge theories are known to have topological charges for every U1 gauge symmetry. So these gauge, these topological symmetries are going to be global symmetries on the Coulomb branch. And so if I want to keep track of these topological symmetries, I'll need to introduce one variable per such topological symmetry. And in this way, I will get the, I'll keep track of all of the charges under these global symmetries. So I'm done here. I'm, this is the formula, the main formula, which helped understanding this thing. And perhaps one last point is to write down the formula for delta. Delta gets a contribution. This is the spin under SU2R. It gets a contribution which is positive and negative. Right? So you have a positive contribution from the weights. Let me just write it symbolically like that. Sum over all of the weights of a given representation, and it has a negative contribution from all of the roots of the corresponding gauge group. So you'll give me a representation, I'll just compute all of its weights, and then I'll translate this to magnetic charges, and I will put this into this formula. Then I'll compute all of the roots, and I'll subtract this. So you take this formula, and so more specifically, it looks like something like sum I and j, mi minus nj, absolute value, and then there is a similar contribution, sum mi minus nj, I less than j. So this is a typical contribution if I'll pick one of these gauge group. So delta is a combination of such typical contributions. You plug all of these things inside, and you get the structure of the chiral ring. The nice thing is that when I have an edge which is connecting nodes of different length, then what I need to do is just put the extra factor over here, either 2 or 3, depending on whether this is 3 times long or 2 times long. And that's the only modification that I need to put in order to understand quivers which are non-simply laced. I put all of this stuff, I grind the wheel, make the computations, and I get a description of the chiral ring of the gauge theory, which further implies the structure of holomorphic functions on a normalized space of system. Thank you very much.
Questions, Tom?
Yes.
Still, we could write that as a sum over sort of magnetic and electric charges.
You could think of this as coming from the magnetic sector, and these are from the electric sector.
In other words, Kapustin labels two Poisson loops, right? So two Poisson four-dimensionals work in a similar way, right? You pick the two charge, and then you pick a representation of the unbroken cage loop, which I guess is not quite the same as a Casimir, but those in spirit. So I wonder, and but he also has a different way of labeling that by an electric and a magnetic charge modulo wild group. Well, wild group acts on both.
On both of them,
yes.
You say. So you'll have wild group on electric charges and on
so there's sort of a sum of a gamma time gamma star all divided by W.
I see.
And I wonder if there is a similar way to express this sum, which might avoid having to figure out the Casimirs of the.
Oh, I see. You want to somehow replace this thing because this is a crucial thing that changes each
yes.
time I hit the boundary of the value.
Right. If you want to put this tip telecomputer to compute this, it's a little bit cumbersome, right?
That's true. So you want to solve this. By perhaps, but then you will still have fixed point of the value group action, no? On the
yeah, but somehow it's a bit magical, but somehow the counting, at least in four dimensions, for two Poisson loops. So if you just take electric charge times magnetic charge, all divided by wild,
yes,
that's the same as doing magnetic charge together with representation of the stabilizer.
That will be quite nice. And then you don't even, since the value group is finite, you could even just sum it up, all of them.
Yeah,
and you don't need to bother on boundaries.
Yes.
That could be quite a nice development. No, I haven't thought of that. I don't know. It's quite interesting. But indeed. So now there is another feature, another issue, right? You have these absolute values. And that's an analytic headache because you have to evaluate all of these cases. So I'm not sure if you could get rid of that. If you could get rid of this,
probably it's harder.
So it might be that you don't have a way out, and you'll still have to divide into boundaries of the Weil chamber just because of this contribution. Well, okay. It's a good idea. I'll have to see if it works.
Okay, if there are no more, let's thank Abhihai again.
Thank you.